This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware Public Media's partnership with Delaware Independent gives us a chance to help highlight more stories in Southern Delaware. Delaware Independent is a website and email newsletter offering a combination of in-depth and hyper-local coverage of the southern part of the state. We feature some of their stories in our newscast, and here on The Green, we occasionally chat with Delaware Independent's Andrew Sharp about what they're covering to get a fuller picture of what's happening in Southern Delaware. And this week, Andrew rejoins us to discuss some of their recent stories. Last time we talked, we talked about land use in Sussex County on a couple of fronts, specifically land preservation and a revision to the land use map involving the Delmar area. This week, you had a piece from Jeremy Cox on changes to the county's buffer ordinance. This has been something that's been going on for a little while. That protects wetlands and streams. The updated ordinance passed, but Jeremy's piece suggests that while it does widen the buffer, which seemed to be like what people wanted to see, it may not be as effective as one might think in strengthening protections. Can you just give us a little background on Jeremy's reporting and kind of like why this is a story?
Yeah, so environmental advocates and others had gotten together with the county and worked out some details for a buffer ordinance that would protect, you know, land along streams and stuff like that from development so that it would serve as a buffer for flooding and, you know, help filter runoff and other kinds of environmental benefits. So they seem to be saying that – the environmental advocates seem to be saying that what happened after they talked with the county was that the county watered it down and made more loopholes and stuff like that, made it weaker. So I've sat in county meetings where just person after person, including people who'd been part of the process, got up and said, please go back to the old version. Like, this is not as good as it was. They also seem to say it's better than it was before. So, you know, they're not necessarily trashing it. They're just saying this has been weakened and we would like to see it strong again.
Which I guess what really makes this a story is like, I mean, this is kind of a great, you know, kind of look into the sausage-making piece of legislation that, you know, it starts in one place and there seems to be a pretty good consensus on like what needs to be done in this case, create that buffer, deal with flooding, deal with runoff that can oftentimes include pollutants that go then into waterways. And then as it's moving along, the compromises come and it winds up being a question of like, yeah, as you said, is in the end something – the bill is something that at least moves the needle, or is it something that just is completely ineffective? And it sounds like at least maybe there was some moving of the needle, but maybe not as much as people had hoped for initially.
And it became very complicated, so it was hard to understand. And one of the environmental advocates said, you know, it's unclear and illogical and an example of very poorly written code.
Yeah, that's usually where it, and that your point is really well taken. It's like for something like this that's very technical, that it's really easy for as changes are made for things to kind of just get lost in translation, right?
So one of the problems that they had with this was they felt like it relaxed restrictions on subdivisions, and not just in this ordinance but all across county code. So, and then also allowed, instead of forested buffers, to have like grassland. And so, yeah, and in some cases, instead of an 100-foot buffer, it could go down to 50 if they put it more buffer somewhere else. So they just weren't happy with those kind of things.
Yeah, there's always also the unintended consequences as well. So,
yeah.
Again, it's probably a story that will kind of be ongoing. At some point, there'll be a looking at exactly what the consequences are and what it does. And we appreciate the fact that you'll have people there to keep an eye on that for us. While we're talking about waterways, you also did a piece on the Woodland Ferry and the latest cutback on its hours of operations. And this feels like kind of like a deja vu story. It's like it seems like every once in a while we hear about the Woodland Ferry, and it's about whether it's actually operating, how much is it really operating, and how much inconvenience is it causing. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on right now with the ferry?
Yeah, so historically, I talked to DelDOT, and historically they have not had staffing issues. It's been more like the ferry's down for maintenance and that kind of thing, but this time it's staffing issues. And they told me that it's a lot of what they're dealing with other businesses dealing with hiring problems right now, just really hard to get people. They are offering a little under $40,000 a year for somebody who has Coast Guard certification, so obviously the temptation for those people is to go find something a little more lucrative. But they had three captains. One of them retired, one of them moved to another job, and one of them got health issues. So the ferry was shut down for, you know, a given period of time. And they're also, even when it's open, they're cutting back on the hours. And that's really causing issues for people who use that regularly. So this time it seems to be a little different. It's often maintenance. Mm-hmm. This time it's – what they're saying is it's the same staffing crunch that's hitting everybody else.
Is there a sense of any chance that it might get back to more normal hours? Or how long is this kind of like more limited service likely to be stuck in place?
They say they're moving forward with interviewing people and trying to find people. So it sounds like – but they couldn't predict how that would go. So –
And at this point, I guess, what are the biggest concerns for people who are using the ferry? Like, where do the limitations, I guess, maybe have their biggest impact on people who kind of rely on this service?
Yeah, so they cut the hours back to about, I think it ends at 4 p.m. now, mm-hmm. which means people can go to work in the morning using the ferry. But if they don't get back early in the afternoon, they have to drive around through Seaford or Sharptown to get home. So and Seaford is having its own construction right now on bridges and things, so it's left residents inconvenience, to say the least.
And probably a little bit frustrated, I would yes. imagine. The other thing that I thought was interesting about the story is you took some time to detail the ferry's history and its role. And were one of the two things that you found in doing that kind of research on the ferry's history that stood out to you, or maybe you didn't know?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating history going all the way back to the 1740s. They don't know exactly when it started. I did not know about the murder at the ferry. I knew that it was called Cannon's Ferry, and it had been run by the Cannon family at one point, not apparently related to Patty Cannon. She, the notorious mass murderer, apparently she married a second cousin or something like that. But these brothers apparently were very unpopular with their neighbors. They were accused of being greedy and miserly and, foreclosing on houses and having, you know, tough loan conditions and things like that. So apparently at one person they were having a dispute with shot Jacob Cannon dead at the ferry one day in broad daylight. Allegedly the neighbors saw this and approved. It's hard to prove at this distance whether that's true, but I could never find any record of that person coming to justice. There were rewards. So it seems like he kind of melted into the woods of Sussex County and was not turned in by his neighbors. So that I found really interesting. The other interesting thing was just that there's been talk of putting a bridge in there for 100 years or more, and it's just never happened. You know, you kind of think of – they say the ferry is a long history, so you maybe think people have loved it all the way back. But there's been people who've been asking, why don't we have a bridge, for years?
Wow. It's probably a question that some people are asking now, particularly those people who are driving home at 5 o'clock and now they can't get on the ferry. They've got to drive all the way around. I also want to talk about the story we featured from Delaware Independent in our newscast last week, and that was on traffic fatalities and how the state's trying to address them. What I found interesting here is that some of the ideas the state is implementing or considering to address this issue. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how the state's trying to deal with this without just saying, you know, more laws? Like, let's just pass more laws to slow people down or you know, keep them from, you know, putting themselves in positions to get into these fatal accidents.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, as you know, cars are inherently dangerous, and so the state is basically trying to make it as safe as possible, which is not very safe. But they really are focusing on speed and trying to change intersections are a big problem, and so, you know, if they can turn intersections into overpasses where even if there is a collision, it'll be at slower speed and at a different angle. Mm-hmm. So they're really trying to make so that if there are collisions, they're minor, and that includes roundabouts and mm-hmm. overpasses in a lot of cases.
And it seems like that's, you know, there's a lot of folks who find that useful just in general in terms of like traffic control and things like that as well. So I guess there's a long history of people wanting to get rid of like the traffic circles in New Jersey and things like that. But it seems like maybe in some ways they're making a bit of a comeback in a way to make things safer and also maybe even control traffic a little bit more. And it seems like that is a lot of what your piece was getting at.
Yeah. they definitely seem to have embraced the roundabout, and there are more coming. So,
so watch out for them.
Yes.
You also wrote about the Kent County Sheriff's Office and how that elected official usually holds another job. Can you tell us a little bit about why that is and what are some of the concerns about that situation that may make it an issue at some point?
Yeah, so it seems to kind of be expected that the sheriff will work another job. They pay them about $34,000 a year, which is even less than a Woodland Ferry captain makes. And, you know, it's difficult to envision, you know, a law enforcement professional saying, I'm going to do that full time for $34,000 a year. I could not get people at the county to talk to me about the time expectations, mm-hmm. Specifically whether they think this is a full-time job or not. But it seems like the assumption has long been that they're going to work part-time or full-time somewhere else too. So and the last few sheriffs have tended to work another full-time job.
And I guess the question that winds up being raised is, like, is there any concern about conflict of interest, depending on what that job is? I mean, we see this – and I think your piece pointed this out. We see this with state lawmakers too, right? It's a part-time job serving as a state representative or state senator. And then they have another job. Sometimes people question possible conflicts of interest there. I guess the same type of thing might apply here, depending on what their second job is or their other full-time job is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the candidates is a full-time town manager. And so there were people saying, hey, you know, they're supposed to stay out of politics. That's a conflict of interest. And you can imagine a number of other scenarios where, you know, that might conflict with sheriff's duties, whether it might be a job in the housing industry where he's doing sheriff sales and also having real estate interests. I think another one of the conflicts really would come with the other employer. I mean, do they want their full-time employee being, no matter what their job is, being a sheriff part-time?
So. It's a fascinating thing. And I guess the thing that stood out to me is the fact that there seems to be nobody who wants to kind of like address this issue head on. And it probably is something that will just kind of simmer out there until there actually is some kind of obvious conflict that people say, hey, wait a second, and it becomes an issue.
Yeah.
So how about we talk a little bit more about, with summer right around the corner, mosquitoes. They're a concern, as always. Maddie Loria did a piece for you on mosquito control in Delaware. And I love this piece because, you know, it's something everybody thinks about all the time when they're out. But nobody, I think, really thinks this deeply about, like, what the state tries to do. And in this case, how bad things could be if the state wasn't doing anything at all to control mosquitoes. Can you tell us a little bit about what Maddie was reporting on you know, this kind of like a different look at an issue that affects pretty much everyone?
Yeah, Maddie's got a lot of experience as an environmental reporter. She does great work. And she looked into, you know, why they do it and whether it's harmful to the environment. And, you know, that was kind of my question when I asked her to write the piece was, is all this spraying they're doing, is it having another effect? You know, as a kid growing up in Sussex County, I think mosquitoes were worse than they are now. I don't know what DENREC has done to change their approach. But, you know, I certainly, as someone who goes outside, appreciate being able to do that without being eaten alive, which until recent generations, if you lived in Delaware, that was just kind of the assumption in the summer. You're going to be eaten alive. And it came with diseases like yellow fever, malaria, West Nile virus, very bad things. And so for public health issues, in addition to just wanting people to be able to go outside without being miserable, they try to deal with this. It does sound like there are environmental trade-offs, other species that could be impacted. They try to minimize those. But as you're aware, you know, some people would say that insecticide companies are maybe downplaying the risks. Mm-hmm. So there's differences of opinion as to how bad the risks are. DENREC certainly says that they're weighing and balancing and trying to do what they think is a very safe way to do it.
Thanks to Delaware Independent's Andrew Sharp for his time on The Green this week. A reminder that Delaware Independent is an email newsletter for Southern Delaware. You can check it out and sign up at delawareindependent.com. And The Green continues in just a moment with a look at a donation of pottery fragments from the Smyrna area and what can be learned from them. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media.